Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Max Hoffman, the Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, U.S. defense budgeting and policy, and the intersection of climate change, human migration, and security concerns. He has organized and undertaken repeated research trips to Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Hoffman.
Thanks. Happy to be with you, Ian.
And it looks as though the United States and Turkey are on a collision course. How much is it to do with the personalities of the two leaders? Erdogan is a sort of boneheaded autocrat, and we have a kind of empty-headed autocrat, if you will. Do you see that as a problem here or a part of the mix?
It's definitely part of the mix, and it's what's prompted this, you know, sort of spectacular public spat. The tensions between the U.S. and Turkey, of course, date back much longer to really 2013 is where they kicked off. Of course, there have always been issues. Turkey didn't allow U.S. troops access through Turkey during the invasion of Iraq back in 2003, which was a major crisis, and there have been previous crises. But really, beginning in 2013, what happened was Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan began moving in a quite authoritarian direction. The Gezi Park protests were sort of the famous example of this, plastered across Western media outlets, and he cracked down on that, which led President Obama to really sort of change his thinking on Turkey and Erdogan, move him from a partner with whom he thought he shared a relationship and values to someone he just had to deal with on issues like Syria. Then, beginning in 2014, U.S. and Turkish policy on Syria began to diverge pretty dramatically, particularly over the U.S. relationship with the Kurdish militias in Syria. And then, you know, that sort of tension bubbled away in the background, but was managed at the government-to-government level. And then in July 2016, there was a coup attempt in Turkey and the ensuing sweeping crackdown on dissent, which further torpedoed relations. Turkey harbored suspicions that the U.S. was somehow involved in it. And, of course, the U.S. did not approve of Turkey's, you know, dramatic authoritarian crackdown. And so those are sort of the long-running issues, along with Turkey's, cozier relations with Russia in the last 3 years, really. But unquestionably, the personalities of these two leaders have contributed to today's crisis. And really, the question moving forward is whether the crisis over these American citizens who are being detained in Turkey and all of the other bilateral issues will be managed by the foreign ministry and the State Department, respectively, at the professional level, or whether the presidents will stay involved with all of the ego and sort of brashness that brings along with it.
Well, on August the 2nd, the United States slapped sanctions on Turkish Justice Minister and its Interior Minister, but nothing has essentially happened since over a year ago. Erdogan jailed two employees of the State Department. These are Turkish nationals working in the U.S. embassies. And all around the world, U.S. embassies depend upon local employees. This is something that's been going on for decades, if not centuries. And the State Department didn't do a damn thing, not a word, to come to the rescue of these people who were jailed on trumped-up charges. And most of the focus has been on this evangelical minister, Andrew Brunson of North Carolina, a fundamentalist pastor who's been imprisoned in Turkey since October 2016. And it was only because Mike Pence, Vice President Pence, because of his evangelical bent, brought this up. And most of the focus is on getting Brunson out, but not on dealing with the imprisoned Turkish employees, former employees of the State Department.
It's a difficult situation. The State Department has, you know, been pressing Turkey privately for you know, since their arrest on the subject of the Foreign Service nationals that you mentioned, as well as U.S. citizens beyond Andrew Brunson who are being detained. But certainly the domestic political side has led, as well as the, you know, legitimate advocacy of Christian groups and on human rights activists on Brunson's account have really caused him to become the cause célèbre, if you will. I mean, the fact is the U.S. government privately had conveyed to Turkey that all of these people need to be released or there are going to be consequences. But the Turks really realized that because of the political interest in Andrew Brunson, as you mentioned, driven in large part by Vice President Pence and sort of his evangelical base, that they could use Brunson, or so they thought, to really earn concessions from the United States on other bilateral issues. You know, and there are a whole host of them, are U.S. policy in Syria, the matter of several arms sales both between the U.S. and Turkey and between Turkey and Russia, also sanctions the U.S. is likely preparing on Turkish state Halkbank for Iran sanctions evasion. You know, there are a whole host of issues, and Turkey said, they the U.S. really want this guy out. Let's throw him into the bargain and try and get some concessions for him. That strategy has really spectacularly backfired, and the reason for that is President Trump waded into this issue in dramatic fashion. He, at the sideline of the NATO summit, thought he had struck a deal with President Erdogan in which Trump would get Bibi Netanyahu in Israel to release a Turkish woman who is imprisoned there, and in exchange Erdogan would release Brunson, or so Trump thought. There, clearly he didn't convey the message directly enough, because the Turks either reneged on the deal or misunderstood the terms and only released Brunson to house arrest in Turkey and didn't release him back to the U.S. And President Trump lost his temper and ordered these sanctions you mentioned last week, and really we're off to the races now, because both sides have domestic political constituencies that are pressuring them not to back down. Both leaders, as you mentioned at the start, are, very strong egos that are not used to backing down or making concessions. And it's come in the context of years of mistrust between the U.S. and Turkey on a whole range of issues. So, there's every chance that things continue to escalate. The U.S. could, for example, lob the Halkbank fine for Iran sanctions evasion Turkey's way. Turkey could do any number of things to retaliate. But right now, Turkish officials are at the State Department trying to de-escalate. And the reason for that is Turkey's economy is very vulnerable, and the U.S., the threat of further U.S. sanctions is doing tremendous damage to the lira. So it's a crucial relationship. Neither side can really afford to let it go completely into the tank. But the politics in both countries is interfering at the moment.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Hoffman, the Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish region's U.S. defense budgeting and policy and the intersection of climate change, human migration, and security concerns. He has organized and undertaken repeated research trips to Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon. Well, the lira has just gone down, what, about 30% just a couple of days. Monday, it dropped to 5.42 against the dollar. And that has to be getting the attention of the Turkish business community. Most of them, or a lot of them, have joined in the kind of kleptocracy that Erdogan and his family run. But I assume there are some more independent businessmen who must be concerned about the broader economy and the future of Turkey. Is there a split in the business community that might cause? I don't know how you stop this guy. I mean, he's had these referendums, that have been largely questioned. He seems to have gradually accrued more and more power. So that's the big question that hovers over everything. And what can be done to stop this guy? And could the Turkish business community be a beginning?
Well, the business community is very nervous, and has been for over a year now. The Turkish economy has been in this slow motion sort of lurch to a crisis for over a year. Inflation is above 15%. Youth unemployment is above 20%. The official unemployment rate is hovered around 15%, but is likely higher. 12%, but is likely higher. And Turkey has this very persistent current accounts deficit, where they need a large amount of outside financing to keep the economy turning over. Erdogan has really exacerbated the economic crisis by, as you said, consolidating power in his hands personally. He's undermined the independence of the central bank, which means that investors have no confidence that the central bank will raise interest rates if necessary to protect the currency and curb inflation. And so And, you know, further, businessmen and women don't have any confidence that the Turkish courts or judicial system will deliver fair verdicts. So, you know, private property rights are somewhat in question as well, which has further undermined business confidence. So the business community is terrified. And, you know, they look at the prospect of further U.S. sanctions over what in their view is sort of a silly political, sort of spat as just the icing on this very, very troubling cake. But as you said, Erdogan has now been in power for more than 15 years. He's gone from strength to strength electorally, and there's no meaningful challenge to his political control. And he has really co-opted most of the business community and built this strong and widespread patronage system in which, you know, big public contracts are handed out to cronies, and cronies in turn buy media outlets and ensure favorable coverage, and everybody sort of gets along. So, you know, he's got to be concerned about the continuing economic crisis. That's generally how Turkish governments fall, is that the economy crashes and then finally voters turn on them. It hasn't happened yet. But the other side of this is that Erdogan has built sort of his right-wing constituency on this nationalism and this sort of threat of outside conspiracy that he puts forward, which means he can twist the U.S. sanctions as a conspiracy to sort of bring Turkey down and try and rally nationalist votes to his side in the local elections next year. But we'll see. You know, at some point, the cost of basic goods keep going up, and ordinary Turks are going to take notice.
Well, in many ways, it would seem to me that both Trump and Erdogan have similar political support in terms of, you know, a red state, blue state divide, if you will, with Trump not being popular in large cities and particularly on the coasts, California and New York and the Northeast, but popular in rural parts where you have a strong Christian evangelical support for Trump in spite of his personal predilections. And it seems to me that that's pretty similar, isn't it? That the educated urban Turks can't stand Erdogan, whereas the rural people are caught up in his sort of Islamist version of, what do they call, what's the party called? The Party of Development and Progress or something?
No, the Justice and Development Party.
Yeah.
You're right, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating comparison, and it's not just Turkey and the United States. You know, we see this dynamic playing out in a number of countries, including, you know, Poland and Hungary, where clearly something has happened where these global cities, these coastal elites feel, you know, comfortable in and see the opportunities coming from globalization, from cosmopolitan, you know, lifestyles, from interactions with other countries. And then there's this reactionary, sort of this response to that has certainly grown in strength over the last few years. In Turkey, it's been building for some time. And, you know, it's a really good comparison you make, because in some ways there are similar stories here. Erdogan says, you know, there are international conspiracies to hold Turkey back, to harm its economy, because they fear our strength. They don't want us to be, you know, more independent. Trump will talk about how the U.S. is constantly getting a raw deal, how its allies are taking advantage of it, how, you know, the international system hasn't done anything for the U.S. So yeah, there are some similarities. And so it's kind of ironic, you know, early in Trump's term, he spoke of Erdogan and some of his strongman tendencies in glowing terms. So it's a real change to see these two, one autocrat and maybe one wannabe autocrat, kind of at each other's throats politically. We'll see if it lasts.
So what's the situation vis-a-vis NATO, since Turkey is a NATO member, and there have been threats, and of course Erdogan controls the press there. So when all that anti-Americanism in the press is being orchestrated by him, and there's lots of talk about kicking the Americans out of the NATO base Incirlik, which is critical to the U.S. military mission in Syria. So where does that stand? Do you think at the end of the day, Erdogan, if he has to choose between Russia and America or Russia and NATO, I can't see him choosing Russia, because in spite of cozying up to Putin, isn't there just, you know, centuries of enmity between those two countries?
There is, you know, a history. I think they've fought 16 or 17 wars in their history. But in the last 3 years, they've rapidly built a very close working relationship. And I think what's happening here is Erdogan sort of wants it both ways. He and his inner circle think that the world is multipolar, that the U.S. is a fading power, that Turkey should be sort of more independent and a strong power in its own right, that Turkey should be able to, you know, be a NATO ally, but also have these very cozy relations with Russia. And they don't see a tension there. The U.S. looks at Turkey, for example, you know, saying they're going to buy Russian S-400s, this air defense system, or giving Russian companies the, you know, contracts to build nuclear power plants in Turkey, and say, hang on, you can't be a NATO ally and enjoy all of the benefits of that, whether it's defense, you know, it's protection and technology and prestige. You can't be a NATO ally and also have these very close relations with Russia. That's not how it works. This alliance is really aimed at containing Russian aggression. And the Turks are chafing at the U.S.'s efforts to sort of make them choose. I think you're right. I think that most sober Turkish policymakers know that Turkey's interests are better served by close relations with the West and with NATO than with Russia, because, you know, Turkey has to buy energy from Russia. They have, you know, extensive pipeline ties. They buy much of their energy from Russia. They have to sort of keep that relationship on an even keel to some extent, but most of their economy is driven by European and Western investment, and they have to understand that that's the more important relationship. But, you know, we are seeing this, we've seen this slow drift of Turkey from NATO. The alliance itself continues to try and play down tensions and sort of talk about Turkey's value, talk about NATO's value to Turkey. But at some point, you can't insulate those sort of military ties, strategic ties, from the politics on both sides, but particularly in Turkey, where this right-wing authoritarianism, this nationalism that views the international community as a sort of a threat, you can't insulate things forever. So we may be at, you know, a real turning point. We'll see. And the key, I think, is whether, as I said at the beginning, the kind of foreign policy professionals in both governments can take control of these issues and manage them slowly and soberly, or whether the two presidents, remain the driving force for policy on both sides, in which case things could really get out of hand.
Well, Max Hoffman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Max Hoffman, the Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, U.S. defense budgeting and policy, and the intersection of climate change, human migration, and security concerns. And he's organized and undertaken repeated research trips to Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down.